Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Danielle Ryan. We are talking all about Misery today, the 1990 film adaptation of the 1987 novel of the same name. So Danny, when did you first watch Misery? Was this something you had watched a while ago? Because for me, this was something recent. I had seen clips of it and I knew Kathy Bates was in it playing in one of the starring roles, and I don't know why I never got around to watching this, because even before I started diving into Stephen King's work, this is a movie that was like totally up my alley.
Yeah, this is one I saw the first time when I was a teenager, because I read the book first and absolutely loved the book. And then everybody's like, oh, the movie's incredible. You've got to see it. It's one of the best Stephen King adaptations. And so I went to Blockbuster and rented it and watched it very shortly after finishing my first read of the novel. So I was probably 15 or 16.
Okay.
And I absolutely fell in love with the movie as well. And I do think it is probably the best Stephen King adaptation as far as really capturing what's in the book and really bringing that to life on screen without having to change a whole lot. So it's good stuff, and Bates is just incredible.
I think it helps too that this is one of King's books that had so few characters in comparison to a lot of others. I've been mentioning it on here quite a few times lately, and because that has this ensemble cast and you're working in two different time periods, you have so many characters, especially when you have to adapt it to the big screen. And with this, you really focus on two core characters in Annie Wilkes and Paul Sheldon. And obviously you have, you know, a few supporting cast in this. You have Buster, Virginia, Marcia Sindel, and Libby. So those are your four people. Two of them are just kind of in town, you know, sheriff or whatever you want to call it, and his wife. But when you have headliners like James Caan as Paul Sheldon, and I know Kathy Bates wasn't as well known at the time and she had done more theater work, but her performance as Annie Wilkes was just so fantastic. You couldn't ignore it, even though, well, to be fair, this came out before I was born. So clearly I could ignore it for a very long time.
I was three when it came out. So yeah, it's funny because Bates was actually the first actress, the first female performer to win an Oscar in a horror movie.
Right.
And it was kind of amazing for her to do that. And it's interesting because she was so disgusted by the violence. There's a lot of interviews and things from back in 1980 where she's talking about, or actually, no, I wasn't 3 years old yet. I wasn't even thunked of yet. It was 90. I was thunked of. Anyways, I can't do math. This is why I'm an English major. But anyways, she did so well in that. And then it's just funny that she went on to do American Horror Story.
Yes,
because
exactly.
It's so violent and it's so disgusting. And it's funny you mentioned, you know, this is one of the best King adaptations, in part because it's small and it's sort of simple, and it's a really tense piece with just a few characters. And as soon as you started saying that, I thought of Gerald's Game, which I think is probably my other favorite King adaptation.
Okay.
In terms of just direct adaptations, because my favorite's The Shining, but we all know he hates it, and Kubrick went wild. So so Gerald's Game and this, I think, would be the perfect double feature of Stephen King anxiety horror.
Yeah, and I haven't read Gerald's Game yet, but I did watch the movie because it's a Netflix original. I was like, oh, hey, this thing popped up, and it was before I had thought of doing this podcast, so I just went ahead and watched it. And I think sometimes when he doesn't have as many characters too, his books are a lot shorter, because that's something that is visibly noticeable with Misery, Gerald's Game, and even I believe Dolores Claiborne is not as long of a novel as usual for him. And a lot of that has to do with because there are so few characters, but it also makes it easier to translate it onto the big screen or a small screen if you're doing something like Netflix or a TV show. But just to have these characters be so close in not only proximity, but just emotionally this whole time, it's so tense. And I loved every minute of it. And, you know, speaking of every minute of it, it's only 107 minutes. It's not a super long movie either.
No, it's not, which is really great, because sometimes with, like, especially these kinds of thrillers, if you make it last too long, if you keep the cat and mouse game going too long, it starts to drag, or it starts to feel like torture. I mean, like you're watching a person be tortured and it starts to make you feel sort of like, oh God, this is gonna just keep going. And Misery has great pacing. It knows how to keep the tension up. And every time Annie Wilkes reveals a little bit more of herself, you're like, uh-oh, okay, I'm following. Something really bad is going to happen. And then by the time that it gets to the big climactic, awful thing that she does, you've seen it coming. You've seen this evil side of her and you're prepared for it, but you're not really prepared for it, because I don't think anybody can quite prepare themselves for what she does to poor Paul Sheldon. And I think it's fascinating because this is Stephen King, who's an author, writing about an author who's held hostage by his number one fan. And that's something that could very, very easily happen to King himself.
And he has had meta moments like that. I recently talked about Secret Window, Secret Garden, and how King based that upon actual experiences that he had had where he had been accused of plagiarism and all of this stuff. And he always finds a way to be meta, especially towards writers, because he is a writer himself. So that's something that he understands more intensely than anyone who isn't a writer in the same way that he is. You know, he cranks out the material, and I don't know how he's still doing it, but he is. And I think with this too, you just have such great performances on both sides from James Caan and Kathy Bates to where you believe every minute of it. And when you read about how difficult this was for both of them, because imagine being James Caan and you're stuck in a bed for weeks on end trying to film this movie.
Yeah. And apparently they had very different acting methods because... Yes. Bates came from theater, which is lots of rehearsal, lots of practicing, lots of making sure that you get the timing and the rhythm of things right. And Caan came from, you know, movies, which really you're just trying to capture a moment. And so sometimes film actors really hate rehearsing, and really just as long as they have their lines memorized, they want it to be fresh, they want it to be pure. And because of that, Bates was really frustrated. So Rob Reiner was like, dude, just put that into the character. Just put that frustration with James Caan into this character. And you can see it. You can really tell there's some real frustration behind some of Annie's pretend frustration.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up Rob Reiner, because I specifically wanted to ask you what you thought about his direction in this, because he had also done Stand By Me, which is another adaptation where you have a small group of characters who spend a lot of time together. And it's funny, I had no idea Rob Reiner had directed anything, especially Stephen King stuff. I knew him from New Girl. And I was okay. Like, wait, this guy directed Stand By Me, when I ended up watching the extras and everything. And I have no other knowledge of his body of work outside of those three things.
He's the Princess Bride director to me. Like, that's it. When, okay. When I hear Rob Reiner, I immediately think, oh, Princess Bride.
See, I didn't even know he did that.
And this was co-written by Princess Bride screenwriter William Goldman. So this is actually the exact same team that did The Princess Bride did okay. Misery, as far as your writer-director duo. And King did a pass on the script. He has a screenwriting credit on it, but Goldman wrote the filming script. And so, yeah, it's really crazy to think that something like Princess Bride, which is this wholesome, fun, goofy family comedy, and then something as disturbing as Misery could come from the same two minds. And Reiner studied a lot of Hitchcock, I read, in preparation to shoot this, and you can really see it. This is a very traditional Hitchcockian style sort of thriller. There's a lot of shots that feel like straight out of Rear Window or North by Northwest or something like that, where you're just like, yeah. Okay, this is very Hitchcock noir almost.
Now that you said that, I'm playing back a bunch of the scenes in my head and I'm like, yep, that's very accurate.
Yeah, it's really interesting seeing. It's basically Reiner doing homage to Hitchcock, and it works. It works really, really well. And also, Reiner only got the permission to do it because of Stand By Me. Mm-hmm. Because King didn't want anybody touching Misery. It was too precious to him. It's he said in interviews many, many times that Annie Wilkes is his favorite character that he's ever written, because she has surprising depth to her. And there's sides of her where you feel empathy and sympathy for her, but at the same time, she's a monster. And so he was very, very precious with Misery. And for when, you know, when Rob Reiner was like, well, I want to make it, he's like, all right, you did a great job with Stand By Me. That's fine. And Stand By Me is a fantastic adaptation. So right. I don't blame him, because that's the adaptation of The Body from Four Seasons, which was actually the first Stephen King thing I ever read. So I've got a soft spot for that one.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, there's a lot of depth to the character, or, you know, there's a lot of story that comes with Annie when we first see her, and it sort of unravels throughout the movie. And at the same time, you get quite a bit of character development with Paul Sheldon, because you see his little quirks as a writer throughout this. And not only is he trying to write a book, but he's also in survival mode. So he's thinking of, you know, this fictional story while also trying to deal with this very real situation that he's in. And I just love the contrast between the characters that we get throughout the entire story. And then when he starts to find out more about Annie, that's also when the audience is finding out more about her. And the way they have that whole thing set up, and, you know, they did change a few things from the book, if I'm not mistaken, but they weren't major enough to distract from the main part of the story.
Yeah, they changed a couple of things. The big one is they changed what she does to prevent Paul from leaving. We can get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But that was changed dramatically. But other than that, no, the changes were really small. And I think that they just helped further the story. And yeah, it's great, because she's this, when we first encounter her, she almost seems like she might actually be good for him. Like, she might actually be helping him. And her twistedness is slowly revealed. And then when we finally find out the full depth of what she is capable of, it's really horrifying. We discover eventually that, you know, she's worked in hospitals and in nursing homes, things like that, and that she has killed the elderly and infants in her care, which is a type of serial killer, killer angels or angels of death,
right?
Which it happens. There's been actually quite a few cases of it, enough that they have their own categorization. So, but what's interesting is, because of that, she thinks she's doing a good thing. She thinks she's merciful, and she thinks she doesn't understand that what she's doing is wrong in any way. She feels completely justified in all of her behavior, and that's what makes her so scary.
Oh, absolutely. Plus, you have the fact that there are certain aspects of the book that would just be boring to show on screen, and I'm specifically talking about the excerpts from his novel. You know, you could have done something where you had this whole fictional world placed in, not quite like a flashback, because it wouldn't be a flashback to anything, but just insert these moments visualizing what he's writing in the book. And I think that would have taken away from the story too much. So I like that they mostly cut out that, and it was more just Paul and Annie going back and forth, kind of, you know, him giving it to her, her reading it and coming back with feedback.
Yeah.
Because we don't need to get that story, really. I think in the book, I wouldn't say it was filler in the book, but I think they gave us that to understand Annie's feelings about Misery even more. But I feel like because of how Kathy Bates portrayed the character, we didn't need any more of her feelings or emotions.
Exactly. In the book, it's intended to help provide a window into understanding her love for this character and her attachment to this fictional character. And with Bates's performance, man, you get it from the start. She named that pig Mercy.
Yeah.
Side note, I have a fear of pigs. That's the scariest part in this movie to me, is when that pig comes in. I'm like, okay, all right, there you are. Misery, not Mercy.
But, I was like, did she say Mercy? I wasn't sure.
Mercy, Misery. Yeah, same thing.
Paul needs Mercy.
Yes, exactly. That's what he needs. That's what he should have named the character, because instead he got what he named her. I love this concept, this idea that a fan is completely unwilling to let a character go. And I think it's something that, as much sense as it made in 87 and as real as it felt in 90, that in 2019 it has taken an entirely new track. And with the fan entitlement and the way certain fans are about things, you know, whether it's like people petitioning to reshoot the final season of Game of Thrones, or, you know, people demanding that things be changed, like the end of The Last Jedi, people, Luke can't, no. Grow up. You don't own this story. And that's really the lesson here, is that the story doesn't belong to you. It doesn't really belong to any of us. It doesn't belong to the author, and it doesn't belong to the readers. It's sort of this nebulous thing that's for everyone to share, and feeling like you have entitlement to your ending is really kind of unhealthy. And I think that's a really smart commentary on King's part to say, like, guys, these are fictional characters.
It says so much about Annie's emotional state as well. She feels this sort of ownership over something just because she's read all of the books. And like you said, people still do that today. They just react to it in a much different way. For most people, I would say, they're all talk on the internet. You know, they're hiding behind a keyboard or computer screen, whatever, their phones. But with Annie, it became so real because she saw this person in need, and it just so happened to be Paul Sheldon. Like, what are the odds, too, first of all?
Right. Like, that would be like if George R.R. Martin got dropped in your lap and you were like, you're going to finish The Winds of Winter. I'm going to watch you do it. Like, it's just not, it's definitely an interesting coincidence that he would fall into exactly the wrong hands, but it works. It works in this instance.
And she knew exactly where he would go to write his books to. It's not like that was some big secret. She knew everything about him. And, you know, while I really enjoy certain things like Star Wars or Harry Potter, I would never put in the time to know everything about every single person who was involved in those movies or the books or anything, because, well, one was Star Wars. That's a lot of people now, given how expansive that universe is. And same with Harry Potter, too, really. It's like, okay, you know, I'm not going to go learn everything I can about J.K. Rowling and then every cast member or anything like that, because that just seems to cross a line that fans should never cross.
I think it's something that happens more in adolescence, and that as long as you grow out of it, it's okay. Because I remember as a teenager being so obsessed with certain figures in pop culture. Thankfully, most of them were dead, so really I just go visit their graves. Because I was a morbid little goth kid. But I remember being that obsessed. I mean, I remember knowing, you know, where Chuck Palahniuk's writing cabin was, because I was a little edgelord. But I would never have gone to them, and I never would have, like, chased them down. But I feel like that's something we grow out of. I think we have to understand boundaries, and that's something that doesn't come until you're a little older. And I don't think Annie understands boundaries because she's never had them herself. Reiner and Bates actually came up with a backstory for Annie where she had been molested as a child. And so understanding that she's never known safety, that she's never known boundaries, and that she feels, you know, sort of damaged by that, then she turns around and inflicts the same sort of harm on somebody else. And two, she also could have, you know, a bit of a chip on her shoulder towards, you know, men, which don't blame her in this instance. But she still should not have gone after Paul Sheldon. He didn't deserve it.
Right. Yeah, I 100% meant, like, as an adult, that is not a thing that people really need to be doing. Because when you're a kid, you just want to find a way to fit in, and you find these things to cling on to. And I think that's totally different, because that has way more innocent intentions towards it. Mm-hmm. And like you said, you were never going to go and seek out these people and these places. You know, visiting graves, that's one thing. That's sort of like a touristy thing to do, you know.
Right.
If you can go to Graceland, you can go to Elvis's house that he lived in at one point. And
right.
And
I'm saving
that
up to go stay at Hunter S. Thompson's cabin because now you can stay there. So like that kind
right.
of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as infringing upon their personal space, it feels wrong. Like if it's somewhere where they're like, yeah, this is cool, you can be here, we're letting you in to our lives, then that's wonderful. But if an artist ever puts up a barrier like, no, this, you know, I have to have space between myself and my fans, I completely respect that. And I think that people should respect that. I think that this is as much a story about paparazzi and invasion of privacy as it is about being kidnapped by a crazy woman in the woods.
And the thing is, Annie respects Paul, but she does not respect boundaries. Like you said, she's not aware of boundaries at all. And that really shows in this. Plus, you have the moment where, you know, she reads about Misery's death, and then she just goes off the rails even more, because that is the last thing she wanted for this character that she loves so dearly. And, you know, I'm sure you and I have both seen movies or read books where, like, our favorite character dies and it just crushes us. But we're not going to go rage out on the people who wrote that.
No, I thought I was cursed for years because I always got most attached to the character that died. Like, I thought that it was a sick joke for a while. And then the older I got, the more I realized I'm just attracted to tragedy. But it was, yeah, it's something that you don't want, you know. You don't want this end for this character. You know, I mean, even like Star Wars, you know, I was bummed to see Amelyn Holdo die. At least she went out in a cool way, but I was bummed. I wanted more stories with her. And I think that's the thing, more than her being unwilling to let Misery die, she doesn't want a world without Misery in it. She needs the story to keep going because that's all she has. And she can't find something else. This is the one thing. This is her thing. And a lot of people hyperfixate on stuff like that. You know, it's just really important to remember when that becomes unhealthy and the fixation is more than your relationships with people in real life. That's kind of where the problem is. If she'd had some people in her life, maybe she wouldn't have gone quite so off the rails. But all she had was a pig, and that's not enough company.
No, I would imagine not.
It's kind of a cute pig, as spooky as pigs are. It's kind of a cute pig. And her name actually is Misery. The actual pig is named Misery.
Yeah. I saw that in the credits too. I was like, oh, that's clever.
Mm-hmm. This ain't no Gidget. This is Misery the pig. Moving to the changes, mm-hmm. We should probably talk about the biggest change and the most famous scene in the movie, the hobbling.
Yes.
So in the book, after Paul tries to escape, Annie cuts off one of his feet with a hatchet, which, funny enough, in The Shining, originally, Jack Torrance had a sledgehammer. So we get those switcheroo'd. And
yeah.
In Misery, the film, we have her. She has a sledgehammer, and she hobbles him by taking a big piece of wood, putting it between his feet, and then whacking his ankles. And they show enough of it. It won some awards. It's placed on some lists, like top 20 scariest scenes of all time, and all kinds of things like that. Annie Wilkes has been, you know, top villains of all time kind of thing. And it's really iconic, that sequence where she's explaining to him where she's, you know, heard about this procedure to keep patients from escaping. And then she just whack, and he starts screaming bloody murder, and she's like, it's okay, we're half done, and she's gleeful. And that was the moment I was like, oh, Kathy Bates can do anything. This woman is incredible. This is so scary.
Yeah, it's really amazing how you can get such drastically different outcomes from Stephen King adaptations. You see something like Misery, and you're like, everything about this looked good, you know. And, you know, maybe some people won't like the changes as much just because, you know, a hacksaw, it's a little more compelling than a sledgehammer if you're trying to remove someone's entire foot. but
the hobbling's more horrific to me. Like, I've seen people get their foot cut off. You know, Audition, she saws his foot off and throws it, and I laugh. Like, it's so goofy. And so the idea, you know, in the book, it's, you know, she describes the sawing and her going through the bone and all that. And that really works in a book. But I feel like in a film, it would just feel gratuitous. Whereas the hobbling is just this instant whack and the sound effect, and you see the foot swing, and it's instant and it's so quick. And I think one thing that's really important to remember with violence in movies is that if you only show a little bit of it and it's very abrupt, it feels more real. Like if you look at the work of Jeremy Saunier, his violence feels so real because it's so abrupt and it just happens. There's not build up to it. It's just this thing. And that's what this feels like. Like this feels very, very real and very, very brutal. Whereas I think of, you know, a foot being sawed off, I'd be looking for the special effect. I'd be like, oh, where's the seams? Where's the blood? Where's the squibs? Where's everything? Where is the hobbling? I was just like, oh, God, ew.
That's fair. I think just because I had read the book so recently before watching the movie, I was like noticing the changes a little more, because when Paul goes out as well, you know, in the book, she had all these little thin hairs or strings, so she knew exactly where he went. And he got stuck in one of the doorways in the book. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember that being as prominent here, where he was so worried that he got marks on the doorframe or anything. And I was kind of waiting for that. And I was like, oh, they kind of glossed over that a little. And, you know, if I'm not mistaken, they changed up how she ended up killing the cop as well.
Yeah, the thing with the strings, the little hairs, that's one of those things, again, that I think works really well in a book, because it's the way it's described and everything, but I feel like it's harder to put that into a movie and have the same level of tension without it coming across like a goofy spy games kind of thing.
Fair.
Like, yeah, like anytime I see a bunch of strings across something, I'm like waiting for the smoke to come out and the red lasers. And so with this, it was kind of, it was glossed over, but I didn't mind it too much because I feel like everything else was in play and I was still very, very afraid of her. In the book, those things, I think, were put in to add that level of fear that, oh, she knows everything. Oh, she's prepared. Whereas Bates' performance lets us know all of that.
Yeah, and even the interactions with the cop being different. I was like, you know what? That's fine. I don't mind those changes quite as much, because if I'm remembering correctly in the book, she ends up like driving over a cop taking the cop car and disposing of the body and everything like that. In this, she just straight up shoots him.
Yeah, I think in the book, she backs over him, if I remember correctly. It's been a hot minute since I read the book, but
definitely gets run over by a vehicle.
She runs him over. Yeah, definitely gets squished by a car. And in this, she just shoots him, which, again, I think it's easier. I'm sure doing car hit stunts are probably harder and that sort of thing. Plus, it also, again, helps elaborate that she has a gun. That's a very early indicator for us that she has a gun. That is something that the audience needs to know, that it's real easy to just mention in the book, but in the film, they needed a way to tell us that without it feeling like a Chekhov's gun kind of situation. Like, we just see her having one somewhere. Oh, well, now we know. She's going to use that. So this is a little bit more subtle.
Yeah, and I think the shooting plays more towards the movie action than the whole ordeal of her backing over a cop, making sure nobody notices anything. And, you know, she's in a pretty remote area, so just shooting him in her house or at the front door, wherever it was, that works, because you're like, okay, realistically, who's going to hear about this? And I don't think that,
especially in 1990 when there's no cell phones and everything.
And I don't think they even had that group of high school kids from the book drive by or anything in this. So it's like, okay, really, nobody's going to say anything.
No. Yeah, she's completely remote in the film. It's weird because I've been out in the middle of nowhere like that. And it's true. Like, no one would hear you. A gunshot would go off and somebody would just be like, oh, a tree must have fallen over two mountains over. Huh. And that's it. No one cares. So she absolutely would have gotten away with shooting him. I do not doubt that.
Yeah. So aside from, you know, some of the minor changes from the book, I really loved everything about this movie. I ended up giving it a 4 out of 5. And, you know, that's really good. You know, you can't really complain about giving something a 4 out of 5. You know, it's close, but not quite perfect. But, you know, maybe if I go watch it again, it'll get bumped up to 4.5.
Yeah, I would give it a 4 out of 5, too. And that puts us right around where IMDb users do. It's got a 7.8 out of 10 on IMDb. So right about the same as us, about a 4 out of 5. It's really, really, really good. And the only things keeping it from being perfect are, honestly, time. Just because some camera techniques have gotten better, some special effects have gotten better, things like that. But if you're able to not worry about any of that and just appreciate it for what it is, it's a brilliant movie. And like I said, probably the best Stephen King adaptation. This and Gerald's Game, which are really, really weirdly similar, actually. It's all about somebody in a bed.
Yeah. Back in 1990, you weren't really getting a ton of people talking about horror movies the way it seems like people were talking about this one. And this is just for me looking things up after the fact because, you know, Kathy Bates won Best Actress in a Leading Role at the Academy Awards. She won Best Actress in a Motion Picture for Drama at the Golden Globe Awards. And, you know, she won a couple other awards and was nominated for some other stuff, as well as James Caan and some of the supporting cast, even though they weren't really in it that much. That kind of surprised me. I was like, really?
Well,
that counts as a supporting actress?
I mean, Lauren Bacall's in it, so it's cool.
Yeah, true. She plays Paul's agent, which is just a nice little appearance for her.
It's just nice to see Lauren Bacall. It's just like, yay. Yeah, there's certain films that this happens to, and people call them prestige horror, or then they go, oh, it's a thriller, it's not horror, which that makes me crazy. It's horror.
Yeah.
And prestige horror I'm okay with, because at least then prestige just means that, you know, the critical folks clombed onto it, as well as mainstream audiences, and it's not just for horror fans or whatever. I mean, 4 years after this, Silence of the Lambs, you know, swept the Oscars and just did crazy stuff. And that's a horror flick.
Yeah.
And I think without Stephen King and what he did in the 80s in making horror slightly more mainstream, Stephen King as well as slashers, because slashers became pretty stinking mainstream.
Yeah.
Those two things led to Silence of the Lambs being able to win all those Oscars and led to horror being taken more and more seriously. We're still not there. We're still not 100% into horror being taken seriously, which bothers me because I think horror is one of the best genres for really digging into the human psyche. But we're going to get there. And, you know, without Misery, there's no Silence of the Lambs. Without Silence of the Lambs, there's no Get Out.
Right. I was just going to say, I think filmmakers like Jordan Peele are probably going to expedite how people think about horror movies these days now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Peele and Ari Aster. And,
yes.
I mean, there's so, Lupino. She just did Tigers Are Not Afraid. That movie is absolutely incredible. There's so much horror coming out now that is just brilliant, incredible stuff. And I feel like a lot of it owes, you know, so much debt to Stephen King, because I feel like he was the first really mainstream horror author.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought horror into everybody's life. And I think Misery is possibly his most mainstream film. As far as the not including Stand By Me or Shawshank Redemption or any of the other non-horror ones. Because, I mean, Misery is the one even my mom has seen, you know, besides The Shining.
Yeah.
And it's so incredible. And I'm super glad that it was made. I'm especially glad that Bates was cast. Caan, I honestly could go either way. I think he's good, but I think I've seen, you know, the list of other actors that were asked, and I think any of them could have done just as good of a job, except maybe Bruce Willis, who played the same character on Broadway, which is just wacky to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bruce Willis. Yeah, Bruce Willis played Paul Sheldon on Broadway, which just, what?
I saw that. I was like,
but
that's,
it works.
That's a choice.
That's a choice. Yeah, but there's other people who could have played Paul Sheldon just fine, I think. Like Kurt Russell. Heck yeah. I'd have been there for that. But it, as is, it's wonderful. And I think this movie belongs to Kathy Bates. more than anything.
Oh, yeah.
The cinematography is great. The direction's great. You know, every other actor in it's great. But Kathy Bates is just, you know, this is her Hannibal Lecter. This is her big, gnarly horror villain. This is her Norman Bates. And she knocks it out of the freaking park. And since we very rarely get female villains like this, I mean, we get, like, what, Jason Voorhees' mom otherwise, pretty much. Serial mom, maybe. Which is also Kathy. Wait, no. That's somebody else. Ignore me. But yeah, it's good stuff. She just looks like Kathy Bates.
I love that this is also King's favorite character work, because not only do you have this female villain, but you have this character who has become so blind to how a person should act that she just has to go live by herself. And you know, as an only child, I get wanting to be by yourself. I get it. But she takes everything to the extreme. And just getting a look inside this character's mind for, you know, 107 minutes is fantastic. And if anyone is listening to this and you haven't read the book, I highly recommend going and doing that, because you get more details that you just can't put onto the screen, because you can literally write anything you want, but you can't show everything that has been written in a book. And it's so refreshing when I get to watch a movie like this, and it's so good, because as you know, and as I'm sure many people have listened to this podcast before, not all of them are good.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, I think Misery is definitely one of my favorite King books, and it's the one I recommend most readily to people that want a horror book. This is really good horror 101. It's really, really, really good understanding of tension and psychology and just everything that King is good at. I like when King does this kind of intimate storytelling. I feel like when he does the big sprawling stuff, it's a lot of fun, but he tends to get lost in his own world building. Stuff like The Stand and The Dark Tower, oh, yeah. That it's really great, but he gets so wrapped up in his own world building, whereas stuff like Misery, Gerald's Game, Stand By Me, Apt Pupil even, it's so much more just about the psychology of these people and what makes people go wrong. And that's what I think King does best, is tapping into evil and showing us that evil can be pretty normal and kind of boring. And that's what's so scary about it.
I love a lot of his character work. And more often than not, I find more flaws with the plot than the characters. And
same.
Rob Reiner just took this story and perfectly understood the characters. And that was way more important than the plot being exactly the same as the book.
Exactly. Yeah, King, that's King's strength. King writes incredible characters. He makes his characters come to life in a way that people get upset when they're cast wrong. People get upset when they're brought to the screen the wrong way because they're so real. These are characters that have life breathed into them. And King has said, anybody who's listening to this that has not read On Writing, go read On Writing.
Yes.
It's the best thing that man ever wrote. It's the Rosetta Stone to all Stephen King, if we're being honest.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant.
I've been debating doing a bonus episode for his nonfiction stuff, because this, I really wanted to focus on his novels and all the adaptations that came with it. Well, not all of them, but a lot of them. And, you know, some of his nonfiction work is just so good. I read On Writing. I have Dance Macabre sitting not too far from me. I haven't read that yet, but it's on my list to get to. And really just the way he is able to dissect his own work, too, in something like On Writing is fantastic. And like you said, there are adaptations that he doesn't like, but then there are ones like this where they just get it. And it's so good.
It's so great. And that's like I keep comparing it to Gerald's Game. And I do feel like that's the best comparison, because Mike Flanagan just got it.
Yeah.
He just understood the psychology of these characters and making it a tight story, making it a very intimate, very personal story. And yeah, I love everything that King does, really. Like, even when he's doing stuff I'm not 100% into, like, I can't get through It. I've tried to read It 4 different times.
It's hard.
I get about 100 pages in and just go, no, I'm done. I can't do this. And, you know, it's not always easy, but King has this connection to humanity, to human failure and to human desire and to all the weird little gross things that make us human that we're not really comfortable talking about. He's tapped directly into that.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what's so brilliant about him. And two, like you said, he's able to dissect that. On Writing is the best book I've ever read about writing. Fiction, nonfiction, whatever. And mind you, I have a 4-year degree in writing. So I've read everything under the sun on how to be a good writer. On Writing is the only book you need, besides the AP guide or whatever. But as far as understanding the craft, he gets it. He gets it in a way very few authors do. And Misery is a prime example of him just understanding how to tell a very human story in a very inhuman and monstrous way.
He's also self-aware enough to know when he writes something that isn't good. I read Tommyknockers and I was like, okay, that was a book I read. That was a very long book I read. And we don't need to revisit that one ever again.
It's like Dreamcatcher. I'm just like, but aliens? What?
Yeah, okay. I am not looking forward to that one because I've kind of heard the same thing about that one, that was not his finest moment. And
it's not, but the movie is a hoot.
Okay.
So
good to know.
So you get that to look forward to, at least. You're going to get Jason Lee. It's going to be just, the movie's a hoot. The book is a bit of a slog, but there's some really cool stuff in the book, too. And again, it's psychology. He gets into some of the mind frame of, like, the aliens and things like that, where you're like, whoa, Stephen King, all right, we're going to do something wacky. So just as long as you're along for the ride, I think you'll be fine. It's not a horrible, depressing slog, so you'll be okay.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, one of the nice things about Misery, both the book and the movie, was that the story never felt exhaustive because
no.
I read It and the original copy of the Bachman books back to back. It was 1,100 pages and Bachman books was around 900. And man, I have never been so tired from reading in my life.
Now, is the school shooting one in Bachman books, or is that in a... I know that was a Bachman.
It was in the copy that I have. They no longer print it, though.
We have a very old hardcover that has it in it, and my husband's like, you're a Stephen King fan, you have to read this, and I read it, and I was like, no, I understand why he got rid of this one.
Yeah, that stretch there of those two books was exhausting, to say the least.
That's rough, yeah. I mean... It's weird with King because I got into him when I was very young. My dad was like, oh, you like this weird horror crap? Here, read this. And he handed me 4 Seasons and said, do not read Apt Pupil. You're not allowed to read Apt Pupil. If I find out you read it, you're grounded. and he told me that the Winter story was skippable. And I read Shawshank Redemption in the Body. And I was like, whoa, okay, this isn't quite horror, but there's scary stuff in it. And I like it. What's next? And he gave me The Dead Zone. And then he gave me Firestarter, which are both sort of sci-fi stories. I wouldn't quite call them horror. And I was digging those. And I was like, all right, what's next? And he's like, I'm not giving you any of the horror ones. It's not happening. So I was like, oh, okay, I got to figure it out on my own. And I went straight to Misery. And that was the one that I was like, okay, I really like his horror. And that's after that point. I started digging into his horror stuff. I started getting into Anne Rice. And then I started getting into all kinds of awful horror books. And it's all Stephen King's fault because I liked Shawshank Redemption. So, but I think Misery's probably his most accessible. I said, it's the one I would recommend. Like, if I was like, Mom, you want to read a really good scary book, go read Misery, because it's not gross. It's not graphic. It's just really tense and really scary and really real. And it's brilliant.
Yeah. The thing is, this is a story that could happen to someone.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing supernatural, paranormal, or anything like that about it. These are two very real people. There are both people like Annie in the world and people like Paul in the world. And yeah, I just really enjoyed this all around. I know we got a little off track there, but that's fine. It was still about Stephen King, so it's all good.
Yeah.
But Danny, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. This is one of the King books I care about the most. This and The Stand, but you don't want to hear me talk about The Stand, trust me. And if you ever decide to do that nonfiction thing, I'll come on for On Writing. Have me and Drew on. That'd be a nightmare.
Noted.
There you go. But yeah, Misery, thank you for having me on. And I promise not to ever go Annie Wilkes on you. I will not come find you.
Okay.
I promise.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. Before we go, I quickly want to tell you all about our Patreon. You can support this podcast for $1 or $2 a month. $1 a month will get you a thank you on the show. $2 a month will get you a Chat Cemetery sticker. You can find us at Chat Cemetery on Twitter and Instagram. And as always, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.